Chick. You are listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. I am here with Christian Mirzowski. Christian Mirzowski.
It's perfect. Nice. Perfect. What is the music is so loud? I would prefer to be called Roger. No, it's Barry.
Okay, we can work with those. I'm also here with Kelly Wand.
The pearl is in the river. You'll understand. That's a spoiler, kind of.
Good. And that's a spoiler from what?
Under the Rainbow.
See, I haven't seen that Wizard of Oz thing.
It's got midgets in it. Spoiler alert.
Good. Okay, well, let's do another movie with a midget that we have all seen. Let's talk about the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, the Gilliam movie. Just to warn everyone, we will be discussing this, assuming that you have seen it. So there might be spoilers.
And assuming we've seen it.
I've seen it. I presume you two have seen it, correct? Kelly Wand, did you walk out halfway through, as is your wont?
I thought it was Natalie Portman's best work, and Dustin Hoffman's never been creepier.
That should have been your tagline this week, Kelly Wand.
Too many cooks spoil the tagline. Okay,
so there's another one. We've got taglines stacking up.
I watched the last 45 minutes. Is that okay?
So yeah, between the two of you, that's good. One of you has seen it.
I watched the middle 45 minutes. So between the three of us, we can understand. I watched only the Colin Farrell parts, but I walked out during the Jude Law parts.
Okay, well, who's going to lay their cards on the table first about what they thought of it?
Dingus.
I really liked it.
Elaborate.
Oh, I'm sorry. I really liked the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Let me put it this way. It made me very sad. Kelly Wand, what's your teaser for this week's episode?
Well, you're both right. It's a great movie about sadness.
It didn't make me sad, though, for those reasons.
Did it make you sad because we did our lists last week?
No. I had seen it before we did our lists. So
you crap monkey.
Yeah. Whoa. Watch your language.
Oh, sorry.
It made me sad because I think it's an example, once again, of Terry Gilliam, that poor guy. I mean, I think this movie was undone by the death of Heath Ledger.
Yeah, but after that, after what he went through on Quixote, I can see him just going, nope, even if everyone dies, I'm going to finish this movie.
And I almost think the movie should not have been...
No, I disagree. I'm glad it exists. Okay. And it's a tribute to his work. And he, you know, who knew Vern Troyer would steal a movie from Heath Ledger?
I don't know about stealing a movie. You didn't like Vern Troyer, Dingus?
No, I did not at all.
Oh,
do you hate the fool character from King Lear?
What movie is that?
Well, Dingus, talk a bit about you. So you had no reservations about saying you adored it. I think those were your words. And that you wished you'd put it on your list for the year. Isn't that exactly?
I put it on my list. I agree with you, Dingus.
I think I said, OMG, I loved it.
So, well, explain, because
I agree with you that it's sad. I just don't, I thought about the same thing you thought about, or maybe you thought about, whether it should have been scuttled or not. And I tend to think that...
What's gained by scuttling?
That it's a triumph that he decided to keep making it. And I understand... Or I think I understand, and I hope you'll make an argument that goes against what I'm saying, that he shouldn't have continued it. But I think it's a triumph that he decided to. And while I think that this sadness hangs over the movie in a way, I'm very happy that he decided to go ahead and find a way to complete it.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel – because I guess my main contention, Dingus, is that the way that he found to complete it, namely swapping in other actors for the parts that they didn't get to shoot with Heath Ledger, compromised the integrity of what the movie could have and I think should have been. I think it hurt that. You don't agree. You think that it ended up pulling through at the end?
Well, I don't think that statement really applies. I mean, perhaps it does compromise perhaps what you're saying is true, but given what his choices were, I don't think the word compromise really enters into it. He doesn't have a choice. He can either complete it or not. Or he can reshoot the whole thing, which I don't think is a choice. So I think compromise is there's no choice but compromise. It's which branch of the tree are you going to go down? And I think that the way they found to do it and the people they chose to do it with. Now I don't know a lot of the backstory, so I can't really speak to that. So if you guys have listened to interviews or read articles about this, maybe you can enlighten me. But it seems to me that people came together and said, we love this man, Terry Gilliam. We loved this guy, Heath Ledger. Let's find a way to finish this to honor them both as best we can.
Okay.
We know we're not going to make any money on this.
It's a eulogy.
But let's
It's only
try.
On two screens in the whole city.
Yeah. And I felt uncomfortable at certain points, but I felt like what are your choices? And of those choices, I just don't think the word compromise really is a fair.
Well, let me explain myself, because that you're right. That's sort of a provocative way to put it. And this is what made me sad about the movie. Coming out of Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, what I feel we were supposed to have gotten was this King Lear-like story about this mythical old man losing his daughter, a struggle between two sort of inheritors, sort of like an Edgar Edmund thing with Andrew Garfield and Heath Ledger. One is the good guy, one is the bad guy, and even a fool sidekick. And he ends up sort of being thrown into the wilderness at the end and wandering around modern society. And I felt that was a great story. And I love that Christopher Plummer was the lead. I loved the arc that I think they were trying to put him through. I loved the conceit, you know, that here is the man keeping the world alive by telling stories, and he's undone by this weakness and this bargain with the devil. I loved all of that stuff. And what we should have gotten, this movie that I felt we should have gotten, this King Lear-like arc with Christopher Plummer at the center, instead became a matter of this really flashy, flashy stunt casting for how to cover up the fact that we lost one of the incidental characters. And that incidental character, therefore, upstages everything else in the movie. And it becomes the core of the movie is, hey, we lost this wonderful actor. Let's get famous people to almost do a benefit in a way and cover for his death. I'm sad that we didn't get that movie that I think we were supposed to get. And that's why I say compromised. And maybe that's a bad word, because I don't want to dishonor the obvious affection that was behind what they did. But I feel that what they did, we completely lost what we should have gotten. And that's what made me sad.
I like that, Tom, but I disagree, number one, that you're talking about an incidental character. I think one of the things that was a real bullet to the heart of this film is that he's not an incidental character. Mm-hmm. He's a very, very important character. And I don't know. I think that the solution they came up with, far from being a celebrity benefit, worked as best as it could have worked, and it worked for me. Beyond that, I'm really happy to hear you bring up King Lear, because that didn't occur to me to really late in the game when he's in a storm and you hear there's this loons sound effect, and then Lear occurs to me at that very late point. And so I'm happy to hear you talk about that, but I just don't think it compromises it in any way.
Well, let me also then say, and Kelly Wan, jump in anytime. I'm not trying to shut you out here. I just want to sort of lay my agenda on the table, and I have a bunch of good things to say about it. But I think you're right that he's not an incidental character. I'm not trying to downplay his role in the narrative arc. But part of what we lose when it just so happens that Heath Ledger hadn't shot these crucial scenes where he's in the imaginary world, he's in the imagination of Dr. Parnassus, is we lose the character arc that he's supposed to go through. This guy who was a scoundrel and then we're not sure about him and he becomes the sort of the villain. And when you have Heath Ledger doing the groundwork there, building that character, and then you plug in Colin Farrell to finish up the arc, I don't see it. I have a hard time seeing this as part and parcel of the same character, part and parcel of this, that character arc is broken up to me for me in snippets. I cannot watch Colin Farrell fulfill the groundwork that Heath Ledger has laid. That just didn't work for me at all. And Kelly Wand, you gave a resigned little yes. Talk a bit about it.
Well, it's just sad that it starts with Heath Ledger and then you end with Colin Farrell. And he stays Colin Farrell at the end.
Yeah.
And it made me wonder, Gilliam insists that he didn't rewrite any of the script after Heath Ledger died. So
what?
That little speech, that's what he says. So like that thing that Johnny Depp says about how, you know, after you're dead, you're immortal in a way. You'll never be
that's
safe.
Impossible. I can't believe
that. It doesn't make much sense. And then it also makes me wonder, just based on the material I was given, like what does Tony represent on the grounds that he's now four different personalities in the script that's written? I think that is lost, so I kind of agree with Tom. But I don't think it ruins the movie. I mean, I think Tom was saying that the movie, it shouldn't exist at all. And I totally disagree with that.
I guess I shouldn't. I don't mean to say that it shouldn't exist at all. Just that it makes me sad that we got this, and behind this, I can see what we could have gotten instead. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
Now hold on a second. Are you saying you wish somebody else besides the actor Colin Farrell had been there to do that final part? Or that concept altogether ruins it for you?
I think both. I think of the replacement people, Colin Farrell was the weakest as far as the actors, I thought.
Okay.
But the concept does ruin it for me. I mean, early on when you see Terry Gilliam trying to build this idea that, you know what, we're going to have a different actor when we're in the Imaginarium. Early on when that happened, where the first kid goes in and they swap the actors, that just felt weird. I was like, what? What is that?
Well, and they're also very self-conscious about those moments. Like, oh, now it's me. Now I'm that guy. So
wait a minute.
Are
you talking about the very, very, very first dude?
Yeah, where they're basically setting
Depp,
up the rules of the...
And Colin Farrell.
No, before think. Johnny Depp, the first
the pre-famous guy. The first
right.
guy, the drunk guy who comes out of the nightclub, where
and
they establish
his face. Well, what happened to my face?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Right there, I just got a very uneasy feeling. Okay, this is a really weird, arbitrary thing that we're rule that we're establishing in this
and
world.
And we know why it's in the movie.
And that was exactly it. I was like, oh yeah, I think because I did not know a lot of backstory about the movie going in. I did not realize going in that this is how it was going to work. I knew that famous people had stepped up and volunteered to do certain things to cover for his death. I didn't know they were going to swap characters like that. So when when they're setting up that rule early on, it seemed kind of weird and random, and I got this sinking feeling, oh, wait a minute, is this going to be how they get around the fact that Heath Ledger had died?
They're just going to tell you. Terry Gilliam's just going to come on screen and explain, oh, okay, look, here's what happened.
I didn't know that was coming up. I didn't know that, believe it or not, that we were going to be plugging different people in for him or how we were going to be doing it. I knew that he had died during this film, but I had no idea how they were going to do that. But that first guy who's the alcoholic dude,
mm-hmm.
When he's saying, oh, what happened to my face, it felt so false and weird and
right.
shoehorned into me that I didn't know what to make of it until I started thinking about the film well after it. And then it sort of clued me. And that's why I was so struck by what Kelly just said, that Terry Gilliam claims there were no rewrites afterward, unless he doesn't count extra shot scenes as rewrites.
Well, right.
So wait,
explaining.
So Kelly Wand, you're saying this whole idea of you go in the Imaginarium and your face changes. Terry Gilliam has said he didn't. That was not a change he made in reaction to Heath Ledger's death.
Well, there's no lines about it in the script, in the dialogue, is there?
Well, the very first, you know,
except
oh, what
that
happened
one
to my
guy.
Face?
Right, right. So that has to have been a rewrite. We just have
it has to because
he's not counting that one. But yeah, he said that the scene where Johnny Depp kind of talks about death being sort of a release in a way, he said that was supposed to refer to himself because the movie's mainly autobiographical and it's about him coming to terms with his own aging and what is in the script before Heath Ledger died. So
which, again, makes me think, you know, this should have been a movie about Christopher Plummer's character. And instead felt like a movie about Heath Ledger's character. And I'm just, that's sort of what I mean when I say a compromise. I feel that shift.
I don't think you're wrong, but it definitely didn't ruin the movie for me just because I was still trying to figure it out and like see if it worked on any level. Like, does it make sense now? Like, what does Tony represent if he's four different guys? Because Terry Gilliam says he's based on Tony Blair because Blair lied constantly.
Oh, that is nice. I like that.
But why does the devil hate Tony again? Was that, did I miss something?
Because I got lost at a lot crunched. Of the way that the all the deals with the devil and the bargaining, the rules, a lot of that got muddled for me. Yeah, okay.
He loses the second one, and then he pyrrhically wins the third one, I think. So he's 1.5 for 3.
And so who was Tony?
That I don't know.
I love the fact, Kelly Wan, that you mentioned Tony Blair. I mean, that's a fascinating subject to me, is also, how the British must feel about Tony Blair. So that makes me like the movie a little more. Thank you.
Mount Parnassus.
Right?
It's home of the Muses and of Pegasus, a hearth of poetry, music, and learning, sacred to Pan, and is also mined for its abundant supply of bauxite, which is converted to aluminum oxide and then to aluminum.
Are you reading a Wikipedia page?
I was. So it's aluminum.
Oh, it's aluminum.
Thanks, Terry Gilliam.
Thanks, Terry Gilliam. But Tom, what you're saying doesn't quite make sense to me. If it's supposed to be Christopher Plummer's story, mm-hmm. and the person I think is the central character dies, but you think you didn't say ancillary, but you said something else.
He's peripheral. I mean, he's supposed to have been a supporting character.
Then the easy fix when that character dies is to just make it Christopher Plummer's story. So there's no problem. But that's not what happens.
Right.
So I don't believe. I have to say, I just don't believe that's the story. It's Christopher Plummer's story in the way that maybe you prefer, or the way that you are thinking that it should have been. If it should have been that, then it would have been an easy fix, but it wasn't.
Well, it ends with Plummer.
Yeah, it Plummer's the beginning, middle, and end, and along the way, an important catalyst is Tony. But what happens is that instead of seeing the character arc for Tony, you know, is he good, is he bad? Ultimately, he's a bad guy. Instead of seeing that character arc in conjunction with Christopher Plummer, that character arc, by swapping in different actors who have completely different, I felt, takes on the role, completely different levels of talent and watchability. And
did they see what Heath Ledger did? Because it did just seem like a really weird series.
I felt that upstaged what should have been the main storyline. You know, and instead, I'm watching most of this movie where, you know, you've got Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell coming up to pinch hit. I don't know what that word is.
Tom Cruise wanted to, but Terry Gilliam said no because he wanted to keep it in the family.
It's pinch hit.
Pinch hit, right. Wow, Tom Cruise would have just killed it even more.
No way.
Yeah, you would have totally just won this argument if Tom Cruise had been there.
But I guess I'm not saying I hear what you're getting at, Christian, is that if that, you know, Heath Ledger's death shouldn't have affected the way Christopher Plummer is either prominent or not in the story, but it's just the way that I think it brought front and center that character instead of Christopher Plummer's character, just to me just felt weird and it felt out of place, and I didn't get to watch the one actor over the course of the arc, and it just broke that up, and each part felt like a little separate bit from a separate movie. And it just hurt what I felt should have been the sort of emotional through line with what Christopher Plummer was going through.
But I guess my point is that if that is what the through line is supposed to be, then you can just drop Heath Ledger in those mirror sequences. He doesn't have to be present for those in the way that he is. And instead they chose to enhance it, which is curious to me. And if you want to make it more about Christopher Plummer, then when those characters go through the mirror, you can drop – you don't even have to have Jude Law and Colin Farrell and Johnny Depp in there at all. And I agree there are problems with all three of them in various degrees. And I also think there are different problems with Heath Ledger, which I'd like to get to later. But I think if you want to tell the story of Christopher Plummer, then you can just drop
the – But so you can't because
– Ledger be the carnival burger.
But you can't because his death is such a big part of the project, and I just feel that's part of what made me
and
sad.
And it was financed heavily based on his name. So Gilliam had –
Oh, yeah. And well, I don't mean you drop him from the film altogether. I just mean you drop him from those mirror scenes.
See, but what are you going to do in those scenes? Because obviously those are crucial parts of what's happening. You know, that's where the bargain is played out. So you need a character in there. You need an audience point of view going into that world, and that's what Heath Ledger's character is supposed to be.
You can't have Anton do that, and you can't
right.
have...
Right. Yeah. And I should also say, I didn't dislike the movie. I liked the movie, but more than appreciate it. I mean, I feel it's another one of Terry Gilliam's uneven masterpieces in a way. And it just made me sad more than anything else because of what it could have been and because of being reminded of the loss of Heath Ledger, who's just a phenomenal actor. I mean, that sequence when Johnny Depp comes in and fills in for him, I hated that. Not just because, you know, because it wasn't Heath Ledger. I hated watching that, thinking this was supposed to have been Heath Ledger doing this, and instead Johnny Depp shows up to do it for 2 days, and I don't feel like he's got any emotional attachment to what's going on in the movie. He's not part of this arc, and, you know, I was just so aware that it wasn't Heath Ledger above and beyond it being, you know, Johnny Depp or Jude Law or Colin Farrell. I hated seeing those guys show up.
Well, I agree with that because, Heath Ledger's presence is remarkable. I mean, he is just a force of, I don't want to say force of nature. He's just a presence.
Yeah.
He's, as soon as he, you know, from the moment you see him, even when he's unconscious, he is an amazing presence. And it was hard for me to see those first images of him hanging from the bridge, although they're incredible images. But when he's acting in those scenes that follow, when he's not sure who he is, his presence is just overwhelming. And I was reminded of the other performances he's done that I just thought, this guy is amazing. I mean, he's like a Brando level kind of guy. He just does it. He doesn't have to even think about it. It's amazing. And you're right, Tom. When Johnny Depp shows up, who's an actor I really like, It feels like somebody has sort of like done a crayon or a pencil rubbing of a guy let's substitute in a TV actor. And Johnny Depp is not a TV actor.
Right.
But it feels like that.
Well, and I think that, Dingus, is part of the mechanics of having Johnny Depp come in and shoot for, you know, 3 days or whatever. To just even if you're a really good actor – like I think Johnny Depp is, until an extent Jude Law, and even Colin Farrell. I mean, I've liked Colin Farrell a lot in some things, but very particular things. And
not the issue. The issue is that Heath Ledger had a very naturalistic acting style, and he's playing this guy as a certain type of guy who kind of mumbles a little in those early scenes where he's kind of like grilling Anton.
Right.
And Johnny Depp, like you just said, it's like he comes in for 2 days.
God, yeah.
And it's a movie star turn, and it feels like a completely different character. And so Gilliam's trying to force, it's a different facet of that guy, but it never feels like the same guy again for the rest of the movie.
And then, and most importantly, you know, the payoff should be at the end when his villainy emerges and his, you know, his trick with the pipe,
Loose.
You know, when all of that stuff, that's the payoff of the character. And the fact that Heath Ledger is not there to finish the work that he started in his own inimitable way, killed the movie for me. Well, you know what? Yeah, killed a lot of the enjoyment and appreciation I could have had for this movie.
I guess you're right. When they're up on that promontory,
yeah, God,
he has to be there. It has to be him again. There has to be some sort of crossing back over for the concept, regardless of what the practicalities are for the casting. Character-wise, you have to go back to who the original guy is at some point, and they can't.
Well, on Roseanne, they had two different girls play the daughter, and you guys like that.
That's true.
Did you just make a jump to TV discussion, Kelly Wand?
Well, Johnny Depp's TV actor, so I
thought. At least she didn't make a Sergeant York joke.
Ooh. Dick York. What do you mean by Lear besides having a fool character and the fact that he's old? Because his daughter doesn't betray him.
Well, no, but Lear is about the the daughter is not. Lear is about the loss of a daughter. You know, that's, you know, being attached to one particular daughter, and being so attached to her that you lose her. You know, nobody's eyes get gouged out or anything. Lear also has, and this is one thing I don't think, if you were to ask me, you know, in King Lear there are Edgar and Edmund, who are both rivals for, I think they're brothers. If you were to ask me the plot of Lear, I have no idea how they actually connect to King Lear himself. But it's an important part of the play, is you have the true heir and then the bastard pretender. And I got a strong sense of that with Andrew Garfield's character and Heath Ledger's character, you know, with Heath Ledger's nature only slowly emerging. You know, nobody knows that Edgar's really the evil guy throughout Lear. Certainly the fool, you know, the railing during the storm. And just, you know, an old man who's used to authority and who's used to order being sort of lost in chaos. You know, that's kind of a big theme of Lear, is you have this man who's been storytelling in a very orderly context throughout time, and through his own foible, his weakness to gamble with the devil, he loses that order and sort of wanders off into chaos and is ultimately in this ramshackle wooden cart going through modern society. Mm. You know, and there's also it's not a one-for-one analogy. It's just I felt like it drew from a lot of issues and imagery from King Lear.
Mm. For me, it's all imagery. He just looks like him. And that thing when he's stumbling through the storm reminded me. It just brought
Ron-esque.
That to mind.
Yeah.
It just made me think of, like, the way they costumed the beard. It just made me think of the classic image of Lear. And when he's stumbling through the storm and yelling, and then there's loons. I don't know what loons has to do with it. It just popped into my head. Oh, this has a Lear kind of thing going for it.
Well, and Lear's attachment to Cordelia too. There are no mothers in Lear, as far as I know. You know, there's this weird sort of, although that is, you know, we do sort of flash back to the story of what's the daughter's name in Imagine?
Valentina?
Is it Valentina? Right. Ah, very good.
Scrumptious.
Yes. Scrumpy. Nice.
Oh, yeah. I like that one of Heath Ledger's big changes to the show is, okay, Lily Cole, you're now naked in the show. That's one of his big modifications.
I got to hit Terry Gilliam for the casting of her. I mean, I love how unconventional she looked. She was just gorgeous and so awesome for that part.
Yeah.
And Dingus, you and I, huge fans of Andrew Garfield. I was, when he first appeared on screen, I was like, who's the guy in the makeup? He's familiar. And it was like a scene or two later, I was like, holy cats, that's the guy from Boy A.
I didn't know that until the end. Like, who is that guy? And finally, it hit me that it was the Boy A guy. I was so excited because I loved him.
Yeah. And he's amazing. And you don't get, I mean, it's a mostly sort of a one-note performance, but he's so good in it and so comfortable. You don't get a sense for what he can do. I mean, anybody listening, and Kelly Wand, have you seen Boy A?
No.
Okay. Well, that's put that on your list with many other movies. Andrew Garfield turns in an amazing performance as, I don't even know that I want to say what he is, as someone haunted by his past. I mean, that's such a sort of a cliched role.
It's not a romantic comedy, is it?
It's not a romantic comedy. And it's an incredibly physical performance, too. He's very comfortable with his body in Imaginarium, but in Boy A, he's one of those characters who is just ill at ease in his own skin, and it's just a wonderful physical performance. He's so good. So I was so glad to see him in a big prominent role like this. And so Lily Cole was great. Christopher Plummer, always good.
Tom Waits.
Oh my gosh, no kidding. I loved him as the devil. Yeah.
Me too, yeah.
Vern Troyer.
And so, Dingus, you didn't like Vern Troyer. He annoyed
you. What's up with that? Come on, Dingus. Don't be a racist.
I really liked Vern Troyer. I liked their chemistry, kind of.
He had a lot of funny lines.
And he did, yeah.
Yeah.
He did, but I just couldn't buy him. I think they needed a better actor there.
Can't buy Mitch in America anymore.
I don't think he's good enough to handle that part. And I understand he's interesting. It's an interesting part, and there's interesting lines. But I don't think he was up to, especially seeing that he has to be with Christopher Plummer so much of the time, or has to be bandying words about with Christopher Plummer. I don't think he can handle it. I think they needed an actor who could handle that.
You're mean.
Well, I would say either get Peter Dinklage or get an actor who can do it and do some sort of special effects or create something.
Wow.
Because I just don't think Vern Troyer can handle it. You know,
deep
good
boy.
For him for trying. And I'm not gonna just say, well, he's a little person, so bless his heart, he tried. He's an actor like any other actor, and I just don't think he could handle
it. Dingus hates all midgets, not just Vern Troyer.
I don't hate midgets. I hate ginger midgets.
Oh, ouch.
And I don't know that, you know, part of that whole, which I found amusing, what are you going to do? What would I do without you? Well, you'd get yourself a midget. Is he supposed to be some other sort of being, or is that just banter?
I thought he was a dwarf.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's what they were.
You know, like Dwarf Fortress.
Right. He was an ASCII character. I forgot
They're
that.
The mythical beings that actually exist, like unicorns. But wait, Tom. Oh, yeah. Someone laughed in the audience when he got thrown off stage. Like this one dude.
Vern Troyer got thrown off stage?
Yeah, by the drunken lout. And then like a drunken lout in the audience laughed. Like,
I thought it was funny seeing him in blackface.
Yeah, I want to adopt. Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah.
Oh, and also only, okay, I know Terry Gilliam is American, but am I right in thinking that only in British movies do you see where they make fun of cops?
I loved how much of a nod that was to his Monty Python roots. I mean, I don't recall, you know, he did a lot of the weird interstitial animation in the Monty Python series, but I don't recall in his other movies so vividly being reminded of his Monty Python roots as during that cop dance number and the spinning head with the tongue rolling out.
Yeah. It felt like seeing a Monty Python movie on the big screen for the first time in like 30 years.
And I don't think there's anything like that in, you know, Brazil or Fisher King, where he's doing the scary samurai characters. They're certainly not in Tideland or, you know, Fear and Loathing with just this weird, wacky Americana stuff. I mean, it was so cool to see that weird, funky British stuff again. Yeah.
And you know, I one thing I really liked about that, the heads, especially when Christopher Plummer's head would rise out of the imagination lands ground, was that it felt like they were saving money in a good way, that he was choosing to do the animation that he knew how to do and creating a design that he knew how to create, because he didn't want to be just throwing money at the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's true, but that's the sense I got, and I really liked that.
The production design in this it was just a gift. I mean, it's wonderful stuff. I'm so glad Terry Gilliam still gets to do that. And when we have Christopher Plummer telling Valentina the backstory, you swoop in, doing, you know, this awesome work. I assume they're miniatures. They're miniatures that he builds. And the camera swoops in up to that monastery.
Oh, wow.
And you see, and I think it's following a bird, and then you see the monks arranged on the floor on their floating carpets, and then the door opens and the devil walks in, and there's an overhead shot of the monks on their floating carpets with the wind being blown away, and there's this beautiful production, you know, there's a visual indicator right there of order and chaos being blown into it, and it's been earned with this great sweeping shot into the monastery. And that whole sequence, that whole time, what was going through my head, and I apologize because I don't normally cuss, but I'm about to, what was going through my head that whole time was, fuck Avatar.
I know. Dude, thank you so much for making this point, because this movie was playing on two screens in LA, the film capital of the world. Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, two screens. Avatar is playing on every other screen, or Sherlock Holmes. And it's just very troubling to me that the last movie Heath Ledger ever worked on only gets two screens for his last thing.
Well, I suspect, Kelly Wand, I could be wrong, but I think probably I'm assuming, and I could be wrong, that it's headed for a wider opening, isn't it? Maybe not.
It came out last week, and this is the second week, and
can't imagine that it will.
Fewer, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's even doing good box office, and it still won't.
Well,
what kind of dark, evil time do we live in? A movie like that.
We live in Avatar.
And Avatar's everywhere.
Well, I want to say that I did not think fuck Avatar, because I'm on record as loving that movie.
Right.
But in that exact moment that you're talking about, specifically where we're following the crow or whatever it is down into the monastery, and there's that incredible shot of that huge outer area, and they're flying in. The music there is just amazing, and it's not overwhelming. And so for my part, what I was thinking at that time, honestly, was fuck James Horner. because the music was perfect. It was just right, and it was just with the action, and I just kept thinking, how is he doing this? Are these miniatures? What is this? Because it looks so real and solid and dirty at the same time.
I think that's definitely Terry Gilliam. Like, that's all that stuff from Brazil is miniatures and forced perspectives, and nobody does what he does. I mean, he has his own distinct look that comes from his own distinct technique, and it does. It looks tangible because it is miniatures. It's things that you can touch, and even if, you know, you can tell, you know, that's a model, it just looks great. I love that stuff. It's, you know, there's a famous scene, it's one shot in Brazil that almost is Terry Gilliam making fun of himself, where you're looking at a shot of, it looks like a nuclear power plant, and then a giant face of some old toothless Englishman comes into frame, and the camera pulls back, and you've just been looking at a model the whole time, and a dude is stooping down to look at it. I mean, that's Terry Gilliam right there in a nutshell, is playing with perspective, using models to confuse scale, and it's just used to such beauty on a couple of occasions in Imaginarium.
Well, and that's why the absence of Heath Ledger didn't ruin the movie for me. It's because I'm used to imbalance with Terry Gilliam, just kind of sit there. So the distraction of a dead lead actor, that's you know.
It's almost like what would
happen. Gilliam standards.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, so you mentioned the music, Dingus. I'm pretty sure the musicians, and I would Google it, but I don't want to alt tab out of Skype and mess up our recording. I'm pretty sure the musicians are the same two people who did Tideland. And I had to go back just because I love, there's this sort of sweeping, almost carnival score for Tideland that I love. And so I had to go back and watch that. And it breaks my heart to see when a Terry Gilliam movie just is firing on all cylinders and nothing has gone wrong and no one has died and, you know, he hasn't lost any of his actors or his funding or the studio hasn't tried to cut up his movie. You know, when nobody is getting in Terry Gilliam's way and everything comes out as he intended, it's just heartbreakingly good. And so I had to go back and watch Tideland shortly after seeing Imaginarium. And that's another thing that just makes me sad, is that he is so gifted, and I just hate that he has to contend with these sorts of obstacles.
Well, that's what this movie's about.
I mean, there you go. It definitely works on a meta level, yeah.
What do you mean, Kelly?
The movie, well, he co-wrote Imaginarium with screenwriter Charles McCown?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he wrote the guy from Brazil. With.
Was it Brazil?
Wasn't he? He was in Brazil, I think, wasn't he?
yeah, you're right. No, I'm an idiot. You're right. They both wrote Munchausen, and they both wrote Brazil. So you're
okay.
Right.
The guy's an actor too. He's been in
right, Brazil. Right. British dude. Wait, what was my original point?
Well, to cover for you, Kelly. I think what you're getting at, Kelly, and correct me if I'm mistaken, is that Imaginarium Dr. Parnassus is about a storyteller dealing with obstacles. You know,
right,
a storyteller
right.
who's being constantly foiled.
Yeah, I agree. And I got that sense, too, that this is really about, in some ways, it's about making movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that whole you can't stop stories being told and the deals he has to make and the choices, the deals with the devil, that's
yeah.
him making comments about making movies in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Right. It's about trying. He has this great imagination, imaginarium, if you will, made out of aluminum.
Oh, it's aluminum.
Right. See?
Well, and there's this rule, too, about you can't let more than one person into the Imaginarium because it breaks it.
Right, right.
Right. The stronger imagination is going to yes. win out. We don't know what's going to happen. It's going to pull it apart. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
So the drunken dumbass at the beginning is the guy who just came out of Avatar. And then
that's me.
Yeah. Oh, we have fun. But yeah. Come on, this movie's good. Tell people to see it, even though it's got issues, Tom.
No, it is. Like I said, I liked it, and it made, more than anything else, it made me sad. And I am a huge Terry Gilliam fan, and I like a lot of his movies that other people don't like. And I I like this movie. I really did. And I just wish it had been I wish it had more closely resembled what I think it was supposed to be.
Did you see Lost in La Mancha, the documentary about his
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And there you go.
That's the baggage he brought into this, so.
But that's one that we never got. You know, I guess I should be thankful. You're right, right. That this is not another Don Quixote. That you know, it's just footage lying around somewhere that somebody could have made a documentary about. Instead, we actually got the finished movie. So,
on two screens in L.A.
I really, it's got to open. Well, you know what? The DVD sales. There you go.
This is a big screen experience.
It really is. Fuck, and that's Avatar. Another reason that I was thinking F Avatar is that, you know, just seeing that stuff on a big screen and just
you've
all the.
Sworn, so it doesn't matter now.
It's what?
I said you've already sworn, so you can, you don't have to go back.
No, but I'm stopping. I'm done. That's enough swearing for me.
One F bomb per podcast.
for 1 year. That's it for me for the year.
What? You keep saying F Avatar, and then and what you said that you went back and watched Tideland again. First of all, Kelly Wand, have you seen Tideland?
No, I want to. I suck.
All right.
Okay, so you know what? All the movies, Kelly Wand, we tell you to see, forget those. See Tideland instead. Put that at the top of your list.
All right. I'm going to buy it right now on Amazon.
But the problem is you went back and saw Tideland, and you're
that's
gushing
cheating.
About how it's him firing on all cylinders, and not, you know, how many people, 2 in 10, 1 in 10 are going to know, how many people who went to see the Imaginarium are even going to know about the existence of Tideland. So it's him firing on all cylinders, but it nobody knows about it.
Well, that
that's what the point of this podcast is.
Well, that's frustrating to me.
That's why I say F Avatar, because everybody knows about Avatar. Everybody talks about Avatar. Avatar to me is creatively bankrupt, whereas this is creatively fecund. I probably shouldn't even attempt that word out loud.
I think you meant effete.
this is just so incredibly rich creatively, and I was just so aware of that during that one sequence. That I just was filled with rage that everybody's instead in the next theater over watching Avatar. And I'm like, you people should come over here. Get out. Everybody, I wanted to run over to the Avatar theaters, stop the projection, wave my arms and say, over one theater, you guys go next door. There's some creativity going on.
Well, I think you're just being – that's crazy. You're being unfair to Avatar. It's not barren. It's just you didn't
bankrupt.
Like some
not
things
barren.
About
bankrupt.
It. It's got some
bankrupt.
Great things about bankrupt not, or barren or yeah, whatever.
It's derivative.
Not those things.
Yes, it is. We've established that on the Avatar podcast. We
you might have, but just because if Avatar didn't exist, those people aren't all going to throw their money at the Imaginarium of Dr.
It's only on two screens. They don't even know about it. That's why they don't know anything.
It doesn't matter. If Avatar did not exist, that doesn't make Imaginarium a success all of a sudden.
I know. I agree with you, Dingus.
Keep hammering away at Avatar. It's not because it's barren or bankrupt or whatever.
You know
it's
what?
Not.
You know what,
it has
Dingus?
Plenty
right.
of things that are good about it.
Dingus,
but,
that
but
is
don't
simply.
Take it out on that movie.
I know. That's just me raging in the storm like an old King Lear. Are you happy?
Sherlock Holmes is fine. Take it out and trip home. yeah.
No, you're right. I am being unfair to Avatar. Avatar is my my whipping boy.
Number one favorite movie.
That's your white whale. That was in.
Don't you try to trump
blue whale? Get it?
Don't try to trump my literary reference with your own, Dingus. I'm the area.
Dinguses? Never mind. I'll just listen to stupid podcast. I'm not huh, listeners.
Wow, that's probably the most sparks that have flown on this podcast since we started.
Don't take it out on Avatar.
That's right, and I'm so excited. We're finally getting out
our
feelings
oil.
About Heath Ledger. Boy, and I don't want to. I want to say that the two images of the two film images, the one of the shadow under the bridge, and the other of Anton carrying of him holding Heath Ledger by the belt, incredible images, regardless of what else is going on in the politics, not politics, but the reality of the actors in the film. Those are just amazing images.
I just bought Tideland.
Did you really? Did you just like go online and purchase that?
There wasn't
live?
Much going on in the podcast. So.
Dingus, I think the whole movie is like full of wonderful imagery like that. I mean, yeah, you're right. And that's powerful stuff. And what great hooks to make you wonder, who is this guy? What's going to happen? What's going to happen next? You know, Terry Gilliam knows how to paint these incredibly provocative pictures that make you want to stick around and see what the deal is. I loved that about that early stuff.
Yeah, I get very excited about the way he packs his scenes with detail.
Yeah.
Because it sometimes I feel like this is too busy. But then I sit back and see everything that's in there. In one of those scenes, I think it's when Valentina runs up the hill after Anton, there's an RV or a trailer in the background where they normally park, like under this overpass. It's, and there's this constant feeling of the intrusion of the modern world, or their intrusion on the modern world. I'm not sure how to put it, but his films are just so jam packed with so many things that I feel like if I don't watch this three or four times, I'm never going to get it.
Yeah. And you know what? That's a fair point. For all of my talking about how I'm disappointed and it makes me sad, I really feel like I need to watch it again. I mean, I will get this on DVD and I will see it again. I mean, Terry Gilliam, I wouldn't say it like demands a second viewing, but it definitely rewards repeated viewings. I mean, he's a man who, like you're saying, Dingus, his composition is so important. What he puts in the frame, what he wants to show you is crucial and it matters. And I can't wait to go back and appreciate that without being awed by the discovery of it all, to just sort of go back and enjoy it and admire it and take some time looking at it rather than discovering it. Because discovering it is a wholly separate thing than appreciating it a second time you see something. And so I can't wait for that second time. All right.
That's all you get, too, of it. You'll never see this movie again. It'll never...
No, it's... Quit being so sanguine on this, Kelly Wand.
Oh.
Did you really, by the way, just buy Tideland?
Yes.
Okay.
I hope I got it on DVD and not Blu-ray, because I don't have PS3.
So one of the great things about Tideland, Kelly Wand, is it opens with Terry Gilliam. It's just him in front of a camera saying, you know what, a lot of you are going to hate this movie.
What?
Yeah. He starts with a disclaimer. It's sort of like he kind of is sheepishly explaining that this, you know, this isn't a movie that many people are going to like.
Wait, is this the beginning of the actual movie?
I think it's an introduction that he shot for the DVD.
I got the collector's edition because I'm a collector.
I didn't know there was one. Rats.
Two discs.
I was. See, I'm an early adopter. I missed out. Rats. Okay.
So, what do you think of the Natalie Portman one?
1, 2, 3. Not only you and me got 180 degrees. I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3. Peter Parker free.
This week's 3x3.
Dude, I teed that up for you.
So that was nice.
I hope I get credit for
it. I think you have a 3x3 for us this week. What is it?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Do you get a commission? Yeah. Do you get an extra commission when you do that?
It depends on how hard it was. That one was an easy one.
That's what she said.
Tom's just... Do it again. This week's three movie thing topic... Is going okay?
Yeah, you're doing an awesome job. You're pinch hitting like no tomorrow.
Three random movies that weren't ruined by babies.
Now give us an example real quick, Kelly Wand, of a movie that was ruined by a baby.
Oh God, every movie. Shoot 'em up, Baby Geniuses,
Stop.
Look Who's Talking, 1, 2, and 3.
Stop.
And you mentioned Ghostbusters 2.
Ghostbusters 2.
And the idea being that once a baby comes on screen, the rules change and it ruins.
Yeah, and you know nothing's going to happen to the baby, so the whole thing's pointless. So it's just a waste of everyone's time.
All right, so Dingus, I think you are introducing our topic for next week. So you start with your first of three movies that weren't ruined by a baby.
By the way, none of mine are actual babies. Spoiler.
Mine are all dinosaurs. Mm.
I think this is the only father in the group, so he'll have a unique perspective.
That's not true.
Oh.
But I didn't realize it was, because you just tagged on something at the end there where you said there. Once the baby's there, you realize nothing's going to happen to it, blah, blah, blah.
Well,
I don't know with that.
No.
All I went with is the baby didn't ruin the movie. That's all good. I went with.
I think that's all that it requires. So what's your number three? What do you got for us?
All right, my number three is a ninth.
That.
What?
Nothing. Go on. Sorry.
My number three is a 1972 film called The Godfather.
What?
Have you guys heard of that movie?
When does a baby not ruin that?
The baby doesn't ruin that at the very end. Have you seen The Godfather?
Well, by then the movie's over.
Yeah, that's like the credits.
But as we know from early in our podcast history, the movie can be ruined at the very end.
Boy, I feel better about this now.
And now we'll go, explain this, Dingus, because I mean, you know, that's the famous scene with the baptism that I guess
you're
talking
about. Is that the baby
you're
talking about?
Yes, of course. Okay. Do you renounce Satan?
That baby grows up to be the opera singer guy and the third Godfather who never does anything and isn't part of the plot.
Is that true?
By the way, he ruins the whole trilogy.
Yes, but do you know who played that baby?
Sofia Coppola.
Thank you very much. And she grows up to be an excellent filmmaker. So.
Wow, Dingus, you won me over. That little baby in that sequence was really Sofia Coppola. Yes.
That is the actual Sofia Coppola.
And you're the only one who didn't know that.
I love the way that scene is edited. It's I'm tempted to say it's a cliche pick, but that's the sort of the baseline for the cliche of that intercut. You know, I just love the baptism scene. And when I started thinking about babies in films, that's one of the things I thought of. And now, apparently I have broken the category because you guys are, Godfather. Rah, rah, rah.
No.
It explains the title. No. We're just being silly.
Yeah, and well, also, I now see
Tom hasn't seen that movie, has he?
Please, I've seen The Godfather. I have not seen the third Godfather, but I've seen The Godfather.
I just spoiled it.
I'm also glad to see that Dingus has a different understanding of this topic than I think I did, which is fine. That's part of what's fun about these topics is how we each approach them. But I was worried.
I tried to qualify last week, and you shut me down.
Well, because I like our different interpretations. I thought that the way Kelly presented it was provocative enough that we could each run in different directions. But what I just wanted to say is I don't think, Dingus, you and I are going to steal any picks from each other. Because I have a couple things here that I was like, oh, rats, I better say this one. It's my number one, but I'm going to say it first because I don't want Dingus to steal it. So the one that I thought you were sure to steal, and I'm still a little worried about Kelly stealing it, I'm going to keep it back at my number one.
Mine are all going to get stolen, I predict.
Go. Oh, maybe I'm going to move mine then. Well, I'm going next.
Ugh.
Okay, sure. So here's my one. I hate to do this, but I, you know, being like I said before, I'm sort of the beret wearer here. I'm the erudite one. So I'm going to pick
Battlefield Earth.
No,
because that
I'm going to pick Battleship
two.
Potemkin, the Eisenstein.
Oh.
What is that stupid? Should I
no,
not?
No, that's good. I like it.
I
you
mean,
don't
I've,
see the baby.
I've never seen it, but no, there is a shot where you see the baby in the carriage, isn't there?
Doesn't it ruin The Untouchables too?
Well, that's exactly. Is that it later ruined a bunch of other movies? But as far as I know, I've never seen Battleship Potemkin because it's like 1922 or whenever that stupid movie.
That's the only part of the movie that anyone remembers.
Right, exactly. But it's a famous occurrence of a baby. You know, the massacre on the Odessa steps. It's a famous occurrence of a baby, but it doesn't, you know, there's still death and destruction. And it's the baby doesn't mean, hey, everybody's safe. Nobody's going to get hurt. The
baby represents oil in that.
That's not true.
Thank you, Eisenstein.
That's my number three pick, even though I've never seen it and I have no idea what it's about. And like everyone else, I only know about that one scene from it.
Well, I've got a
movie about a battleship and no one remembers any of it. Go on. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I've got a pick that's right along those lines that I didn't pick, but too bad.
Have any of you guys seen Battleship Potemkin?
Yes, I saw it in film school.
Oh, you went to film? Well, see, there you go. Yeah, I think only people in film school have seen that movie.
Yeah, that's the only place you can see it.
Right. You can't, like, Netflix that, can you?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
I saw it in Sunday school.
No, Dingus, you did not. All right, well, Dingus, oh, no, Kelly Wand, what's your number three?
My number three is Alien, because it's the best birth scene ever. Okay, that's my number three.
It is a baby, I guess. I mean, he's got a point.
See?
One thing I love about Kelly is that...
It eats spaghetti instead of breast milk. Oh, guys. Spoiler alert.
Very nice.
One thing you love about Kelly is what, Dingus?
One thing I love about Kelly is that he has equal disrespect for his own category as for ours.
It's very true. Dingus, what's your number two movie that wasn't ruined by a baby?
My number two movie is an action film called Hard Boiled.
Oh, my. So, Dingus, okay, first of all, okay, now I'm going to lay the smack down. Dingus, you have instead picked a movie that was ruined by a baby. Because if I'm not mistaken, in Hard Boiled, doesn't he catch fire and the baby pees on him and puts the fire out?
Yeah, that, and that there, saves the movie.
That's the movie ruined by a baby. You did it wrong. Go
but
back.
Saved by pee.
No, but if it had been an American film, what would have happened is after the end of the action scene, the baby then would have peed on him to put out the fire, and it would have been everybody laughing about it. But what happens is the baby pees on him, and when he actually runs and tries to jump out the window and can't jump out the window. This is great, great thing where he's running and there's this action going on and flames flying everywhere. He's on fire. He leaps to the window, and in an American film, he breaks through the window and flies out the window and lands safely. And then the baby pees on him, and there's a tagline and it's a button, and it's a funny button, but he can't get out the window. He's unable to jump out the window, and he's on fire. And then the fire gets put out, and then he can get out the window. So the baby contributes to saving him, and thus saves the movie.
No, gosh.
So you are wrong.
Not only do you
stole fizzy lifting drinks, you get nothing.
Not only do you misunderstand the category, you now misunderstand movies. Ugh, I cannot believe. As a matter of fact, that Kelly Wand should have been like when you're talking about movies ruined by the presence of babies. The baby changes all the rules in Hard Boiled. That's a classic example of a movie ruined by a baby. Dingus, you're fired.
You know, the whole thing is they're saving a whole bunch of babies.
Yeah,
but there's only one he's carrying. Although in the second one, when the baby defuses the bomb with its vomit, that part's good.
Wow, is that really happens?
No.
Oh,
I like people.
I don't know movies.
Kelly Wand, are you with me though that Hard Boiled is not an example of a movie not ruined by a baby?
I'm kind of with you, yeah. Okay. But I like that movie anyway.
Oh, I do too.
There's non-baby parts that are good.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's a classic example of, hey, once the baby comes out, the rules change.
But I don't think you're supposed to think of it as a real baby. I think it's just a John Woo movie extra baby. So I don't really take it seriously as even a baby ruining a movie. It's just like a prop ruining a movie.
Yeah, okay. I'll go with you there. All right, well, my number two. So here, Dingus.
It doesn't qualify as a real baby.
Here, Dingus is
as opposed to the one in Battleship Potemkin.
Or Alien.
Plastic.
Here's an example of a baby where the baby comes out and the stakes do not change. If anything, like the rules do not change. If anything, it's just as dire once the baby has appeared. The baby even makes it heightens the tension more. It makes it worse. It makes what you're watching more horrific. So Wes Craven did these like crappy like 70s horror movies. It's like classic grindhouse stuff, and I don't really have much use for that anymore. I've tried to watch Last House on the Left recently, and that stuff is junk. I can't even watch that. However, he did a movie called The Hills Have Eyes way back when about cannibals attacking a family. And again, it's just grindhouse junk. I haven't even seen that one. I've heard of it.
What?
But it was made into a remake. As soon as like this Texas, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer started remaking Texas Chainsaw Massacre and all that stuff, Wes Craven was like, hey, let's remake some of my early crappy movies, like, and we'll do that, like they did with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Of them they remade was The Hills Have Eyes, and he turned it over to a French director named Alexander Aja, and Alexander Aja works with a fellow named Gregory Levasseur, who is his production designer, and they're their team, and they have a very distinctive look. They did a movie called High Tension. So they did this remake of Hills Have Eyes, and their remake is that 70s grindhouse, borderline tasteless sensibility with art house visuals, and in the case of this remake of Hills Have Eyes, a really good, strong cast. And one of the things that happens early on, and this is part of the original Hills Have Eyes and the remake, is that this baby gets basically carried off by mutant cannibals. And it's about not the family, because a lot of the family members are killed, but it's about the baby's father trying to get the little baby back. And none of the tone of the movie does not soften the least once the baby is carried off. And even, like I said, I haven't seen the original, but in the remake, the mother, you know, is brutally killed while the baby is present on screen. And normally, like, that's just, you don't do that in a normal movie with a little baby and a mother. And there's even, it's not a rape, but it's this really weird molestation takes place, like, while the baby is there. And it's really hardcore, tough to watch, R-rated content. And a baby does not ruin it.
Well, do they save the baby at the end?
Well, it's the point.
You're never going to see it.
Well, you should see it. I mean, it's a great horror movie. And the point of these horror movies is, as I've said before, it's how one character goes from being an unlikely survivor to someone spattered with blood, and you know, he's come through this cauldron of violence and been transformed. And the Hills Have Eyes remake is almost about rebuilding a family structure in a cauldron of violence. And the art house sensibility that partly goes with the remake is that Alexander Aja has this weird commentary about America and nuclear testing. And you get the sense that he's, in a way, maybe talking about what the Cold War has done to the world. I mean, it's like I say, it's very art house stuff and it's subtext.
Kind of like Spielberg did in Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull.
I couldn't get the bat off my shoulder.
One, two,
nicely done,
three.
Kelly.
So, okay, well, that's my number two pick.
Do they save the baby? Because if they do, that movie's ruined.
Don't answer the question.
Well, it's about rebuilding a family structure. It's about what that baby,
I smell hard-boiled.
It's about what that baby is transferred into. You know, the what the baby starts with, and he goes through with this mutant cannibals who've kidnapped him, and what he gets left with, it's about a transformation. So whether or not the baby survives is almost irrelevant as to what the new family structure is. What does the baby survive into?
A cannibal, right? I forget. I saw the movie, but I forget. So it can't be that good. I think, Tom, you're overselling that movie a little.
Like I said, I haven't seen the original. I might be overselling the remake, but I think the remake is one of the truly great horror films.
I like the original and the sequel to the original. You heard me. Hills Have Eyes 2. It's got like the same trolls in it.
Yeah, they did a sequel to the remake as well, which is just terrible, and is young people getting, it's a basically young people in a slasher film. It's like young people just getting killed right and left, and the first movie is nothing like that. So, alright.
Did you see the Day of the Dead remake?
Well, now we're talking about zombie movies.
Alright.
So I'm not sure how that ties in, but yes, of course.
That will tie into my number two.
Alright.
Alright, I'll do that one first then.
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to preempt you.
Or somebody steals it. Okay, my number one. I'll just do my number two later.
Okay.
Wait a minute. What?
Nah, Tom scared me now. Doing some transpositions.
I did not pick the Dawn of the Dead remake, if that's what you're worried about.
Oh, okay. I'll put off my number one then.
Okay.
Because that wasn't it. My number two is Trainspotting.
Yeah, good one.
Yeah, right. Obvious. Okay. Fingus go.
And that's just like a dream sequence, isn't it? Why is he dreaming about a baby on the roof? It was not dreaming. Like he's, go
well, ahead. It's not dream.
Yeah,
it's a hallucination.
Right. He's on heroin. But what? Why is he freaking out about a baby on the ceiling? What's the context for that?
Well, there's
because
a baby in there.
He's drying out, and a baby died because they were all on heroin earlier in the movie. Yeah. So he's tripping out on that baby. But it's a different mutant baby from the baby that died.
Okay.
Does that help? Trainspotting.
Sure, yeah.
But that guy directed 28 Days Later, so in a way, it's the perfect transition to Dinguses, number two.
Okay, my number two is hard-boiled. Why do I have to keep doing my number two?
Oh, wait. What is it?
Dinguses on his number one.
Number one, sorry.
My number one is the Day of the Dead remake.
No, it's not.
Oh, no, it isn't. That's right.
First of all, you haven't seen the Day of the Dead remake.
Yeah, and that's not even what he said, right?
All right.
Really, my number one is Joshua.
Oh.
Have you guys seen
is
Joshua?
Is that the clone movie? It's about a clone boy, right?
First of all, Kelly Wand, shut up.
Okay.
I think you might be spoiling something you haven't seen. No, it's not. Go ahead, Dingus. I like this.
It might have been my favorite film at Sundance when I went in 2007. And this was a really hard pick for me because I usually have a very, very difficult time enjoying films when babies or children are in jeopardy. It's corn syrup, yeah. It's oil syrup. It usually takes me out of the film. I have a hard time with that. But the craft, this film is so well made that it got me through that. And I don't want to say too much because I want people to see films like Joshua. But there's a baby who's in jeopardy throughout the film, and it could have ruined it for me, and it did not ruin it for me.
This would actually apply to the intent of the list, Dingus, as well as your actual choices, is that I like, you know, the presence of the baby in Joshua did not change the rules or make it seem like they were pulling any punches or, Yeah, that's a good pick. I like that. Very well done.
Kelly, one, you should. Joshua, should I order it on Amazon right now while you talk about stuff?
Joshua isn't necessarily something you need to own, but it's like as far as like watching movies. Would you call Joshua a horror movie?
Oh, I don't know. Don't know how to. I think it's more of a thriller. But Kelly, I would say there's a bunch of other movies you need to see before that.
I'm not big on labels like horror, man.
This ties into my number one, which I was sure someone was going to scoop. It's Children of Men, where the hero is tasked with protecting a baby, very much like in Hard Boiled. But the presence of the baby is so integral to the world that's created in that movie. And the role of the baby in transforming the character, too. How it builds into Clive Owen's backstory and where he ends up at the end of the movie, the final shot, which I won't ruin. But how it fits into his backstory. And specifically, there's an awesome action sequence that this baby brings to a halt because of what babies mean in this world. I love what the baby did in terms of bringing an action sequence to a literal standstill without ruining the movie.
Don't say literal.
I when I say literal, Kelly Wand, I literally.
You literally mean literal.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that pick because that was one of my favorite moments in film that year. That's a great pick.
So did you just not, because I was sure when I came up with that dingus, I was sure one of you guys was going to scoop me, so I was going to put it, I was going to say it first before one of you guys could say it.
I saw this borderline ruin the movie, because you know nothing's going to happen to the baby in that.
I don't agree.
You made a good case for it, so yeah. I have to chat with you.
That was one that I had that I thought somebody else was going to pick this, so I'm going to try to pick something else.
You did not. You thought that far ahead? Why don't you just do it as your number three and gamble? That's the fun way to play this game.
Shall I read all of those things?
He doesn't live as dangerously as you and I do, Kelly Wand.
I see. We're gamers. We see it as a game.
Yeah. Dingus is more.
I had a pick that I thought would just annoy you, Kelly Wand. I almost picked
2001.
One that would.
2001.
No. 2010. Oh.
That hasn't been.
I was going to pick 2010 as the better of the 2001, 2010 movies.
There's
That's
not a
right.
Second one, is there?
What?
Who's the baby in the second one? Who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? Okay. I play the who cares card.
Well, from the who cares card, Kelly Wand, as your oh no, wait, is it whose turn is it?
You.
It's Kelly. We're at number one. We're at number one of one.
No, I always do the short, simple one after Tom gibbers like an animal for 10 minutes. Of Tom's gibbering number one.
No, I did my 10 minutes of gibbering about Children of Men.
Oh yeah, you're right. That's what I meant. Okay, my number one is. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to imply you hadn't gibbered yet. My number one baby movie, not ruined by, is Peter Jackson's Dead Alive. Did you guys ever see that?
Yeah, I don't remember a baby from that. I remember a monkey.
It's the best. It's my favorite movie, baby ever. It's so good. The zombies make love and they produce a baby and it gets in a radio. It's just like, and he takes it for a walk in the park in that carriage. You don't remember that? Where he goes to the park and it gets kicked around and stuff. And it's trying to bite everyone and bite him and he's trying to like burp it. You know,
wow. Man, no, I don't remember that.
And it gets inside a girl, there's a girl with glasses. It gets inside her and like pulls her face apart.
Oh, yeah, I definitely remember that. That's a bit, wow. No, that's a famous shot. That might even be the box cover or something, is the baby coming out of her mouth. Or
the unrated version, which was cut by the Blockbuster version. But wow. Yeah, I forget how they get rid of the baby. It dies some awesome death somehow. Forget what it's come up and said.
You know, I should see that again, if for no other reason than to clear my palate of Lovely Bones.
Ooh. You hate that movie that much?
Yeah, Lovely Bones is terrible. It's horrible.
It's horrible?
Yeah, oh God, absolutely, yeah.
We didn't do a podcast about it. You're not even going to, like, make us see it.
No, yeah, we'll want to skip that. I mean, it's really, this is sort of terrible to say, but I was, Lovely Bones is worth watching to laugh at, if nothing else. I mean,
what?
Yeah, oh, come on, please, are you serious? Come on, he's totally, he has
I
no...
It was like a Heavenly Creatures kind of thing.
You read the book, didn't you, Tom?
I tried. I didn't stick with it. Yeah, my girls' book club didn't stick with it. I started reading the book and just gave up on it, so I didn't really care for the source material. But no, it's so just clumsy and it's just sappy and the fantasy sequences are just handled so poorly. So I need to see Dead Alive again to appreciate my early Peter Jackson. Well, what I need to see again is Heavenly Creatures.
Did you see Meet the Feebles?
You know what? I've never seen that one. Is that the puppet thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's dirty puppet. It's like Ralph Bakshi puppets.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
It's not so much good, but it's good to have said you've seen it.
Right, right. So I'm just going to say I've seen it.
Oh, yeah, you didn't see that? Yeah. No, you have to sit through it. You have to earn it, Tom. I have to put it to
you. No, but I paid my dues by watching The Lovely Bones.
I want to find out why Lovely Bones is so bad.
Bad taste. Did you guys see that one? It's like kind of student-filmy one.
That's like some aliens thing with...
like
I know
alien cannibals. And like his mom baked the prosthetics or something. It was very student film.
Dingus, you know why Lovely Bones would be bad. I mean, you know the subject, right?
Well, barely, but he makes good movies, or he made a few good movies.
I don't think he really has... Like, it just feels like there's an obvious sense...
It only takes one movie to suck.
That's a good point. But there's a sense that he's really that he cares about, like, the Lord of the Rings movies. You get this sense that he really put his heart and his energy for years on end into this. And, you know, he created an entire company just to make this. And Lovely Bones, just nobody in it feels like they have much connection with the material. The lead girl, they don't do much with her. The little dream sequences. That's another thing, too. Almost, I don't want to get back too much into Imaginarium, but... As you might know, in Lovely Bones, there are these sort of fantastical dream sequences where a character is in a kind of a dream world. It is literally sort of a girl in heaven, and it's her concept of heaven. And there's just no heart in any of those scenes. It's just like sort of a colored palette. Like, let's put her in a lovely yellow corn, in a lovely yellow field of wheat, and then we just cut back and forth between what she's supposed to be seeing in the real world and her watching. And they just have shots of this poor young actress sort of reacting and overreacting to things. And they intercut that with Mark Wahlberg just doing his worst. And even, oh my God, Rachel Weisz. How can you blow putting Rachel Weisz in these supposedly really powerful emotional scenes? And sure enough, they do. You know, there's no heart there.
She turned down the money for that?
So there you go. So, Dingus, you have a 3x3 for us for next week, if I'm not
mistaken. Yay!
Yes, I do.
What do you got for us?
All right, your 3x3 assignment for next week, if you choose to accept it or even if you don't, is your three best gas station scenes.
Oh, I like it.
All right. Do we need any further elaboration? I don't think we do. I like...
Well, let me ask you this.
Okay.
Should we expand it to include convenience stores or just keep it gas stations?
You're going to have to make that call, Dingus. This is your 3x3. 3x3 is not a democracy, Dingus. It's a dictatorship.
All right, then I say three best gas station scenes.
So you have to be able to fill up your tank in the front. If there's no gas on sale on the premises, it does not count. Fair enough.
The cashier's not inside behind the glass. It doesn't count.
There has to be gas involved. That's right, and not just farts. One, two, three.
Good. Okay, I like this.
All right, I'm one-third done. keep talking. I'm going to finish this before the end of the podcast.
Well, I'm sorry. We're out of time. That's it. So next week we'll be back to talk about Youth in Revolt.
Michael Cera, we haven't seen enough movies with him yet. He's not overexposed at all.
Well, we'll find. Let's find out. Let's see. Does this movie tip? Does it fill our Michael Cera tolerance level past the tipping point? We'll find out. So join us next week. I am Tom Chick. I am here with Christian Moretzky.
That's it, Christian Moretzky.
And Kelly Wand.
Pearls in the River. That song makes more sense in hindsight, huh, listeners?